Paragraphs 7, 8, 9, and 10. Paragraph 7 goes over property condition. It just really talks about inspections and repairs of the property, and it goes through the timelines and requirements for those inspections and repairs of the property. Paragraph 8 discusses broker fees. It simply states that broker's fees are contained in a separate agreement. They're not going to be in this contract or laid out in the 1-4 family contract. A totally separate side agreement is where they're maintained. In paragraph 9, it goes over the closing. So really, it just gives you the date of closing and the requirements for closing. And then paragraph 10 talks about possession. Either it's upon closing or it's according to a residential leaseback, which either can be with the TREC promulgated form or another written lease that's probably prepared by an attorney, hopefully. If it is a TREC promulgated form, lenders should really pay close attention to this, because the TREC promulgated form, you can see at the top of the seller's residential lease, it says that it is good for up to 90 days. However, an owner-occupied rate prepared by the lenders is if the owner moves into the house within 60 days. So it is important for the lender to really look at that residential lease back to see when the buyer is actually occupying the property, because it can make a difference on the interest rate. Paragraphs 11, 12, and 13. Paragraph 11 goes over special provisions, which is actually a very contentious paragraph in the TREC contract, because it can, when realtors decide to write in special provisions, it can constitute practicing law without a license, which really is why TREC came up with all the promulgated addenda that they have these days to prevent the realtors from practicing law without a license. Paragraph 12, settlement and other expenses. This is really just for who pays for the loan closing costs and the other fees, and how much are they paying. And then paragraph 13 goes into prorations. We, as a title company, do the best job that we can to prorate taxes on the best estimate that we have, which is typically DCAD and a tax certificate that we order from a certified tax company. When that tax certificate comes in, we prorate based on their estimates for 2020. However, that's just an estimate. It doesn't become a hard and final taxes until that final tax bill comes out, which is usually mid-October. When that tax bill comes out, we can actually collect the taxes. But before then, between basically January 1st and mid-October time, we have to estimate. And so under the contract, the parties agree to re-prorate once the tax bill is final. So that actually survives closing, which we'll go into a little bit later, but that agreement to re-prorate does extend past the closing date. Paragraphs 14, 15, 16, and 17. Paragraphs 14 just goes over casualty loss. It simply states that the seller is responsible for the casualty loss on the property, whether that be fire damage or other casualty loss on the property during the time of the contract, from the effective date to the closing date. And the seller is required to repair the property. And if they do not, the buyer has the right to terminate. Paragraph 15 goes into the default. So if the seller defaults, what are the buyer's remedies? If the buyer defaults, what are the seller's remedies? Paragraph 16 simply states that the parties agreed to mediate before proceeding to other dispute resolution processes. And paragraph 16 discusses who pays for attorney's fees. Paragraph 18 and 19. Paragraph 18 goes over escrow, which discusses that the escrow agent is not a party to the contract, but it also talks about the deposits of the escrow money under the contract and the releases under the contract. This is really important for buyers and sellers to know, because when there's an expense incurred on behalf of the person that is receiving the returned earnest money, whether that be the buyer or seller, if they have incurred expenses during this time period that we have had the earnest money, that expense will be deducted from the amount of the returned earnest money. So for example, if the buyer during the option period is required to order a survey to get it in for the time period allotted, they order the survey, we order it for them, the surveyor sends us an invoice, and the buyer decides to terminate the contract during the option period, but they've still ordered a survey, and so the surveyor has already provided that to us. if the earnest money is going to be released to the buyer, we will deduct that money from the survey cost from the earnest money before returning that earnest money to the buyer. The same would go for a seller. So if the seller were to order a survey and the seller is getting the earnest money, we would deduct that expense from the earnest money because there's no other way to collect the money if the contract doesn't go through. So if there's no closing statement at the end, at closing day, and there's no money being exchanged, the only money that we have to deduct these expenses from is the earnest money. So that paragraph 18 really allows the title company to deduct that expense from whatever is provided to us. Paragraph 19. This is the representation paragraph that I was talking about earlier when we were discussing tax prorations. So all covenants, representations, and warranties survive closing. This is specifically important for the tax proration purposes because when the parties agree to reprorate, even though they may have closed in January and that tax bill comes out in October, they still owe under the contract per their agreement.